For years, Professor George Lakoff has been a groundbreaking researcher and analyst of the interplay between human archetypes and individuals. Hailed as the father of framing, George is the author of a number of seminal books that are immensely helpful to those of us struggling to understand the world around us. Dr. Lakoff has recently taken the time to compose two lengthy articles examining the Trump phenomenon, and I am grateful that he's agreed to be back with us on State of Belief Radio. George, welcome back.
My pleasure. Always good to talk to you.
You make clear in your writing that there's no way to briefly summarize an analysis of Donald Trump and his supporters, so I won't ask you to do that. But it would be helpful if you reintroduced our listeners to the concept of archetypes as it applies to this campaign.
Well, it has to do with the nature of the brain. The fact is that 98% of thought, believe it or not, is unconscious. It's carried out by neural circuitry. Ideas don't float in the air. They're carried out by neural circuitry in your brain. You don't have conscious access to it. And that neural circuitry affects things. And it turns out that every idea or collection of ideas that you have is there physically in your brain in some complex neural circuit. And in some cases, we actually know a lot about the structure of those circuits. I'm finishing a book on that right now, with what we do know. And the important part of that is that you can only understand what your brain allows you to understand. If you have hear some facts that don't fit what your brain allows you to understand, what's going to happen? What will happen is they will either be puzzling and strange, or they'll be ignored and not noticed, or they'll be rejected, or they'll be ridiculed, or they'll be attacked if they're threatening, because when you have two opposite political ideologies, they are in different brain structures, and they, inhibit each other. Now, what's very important about this is that many people, people who are called moderates, have both ideas. If you're a moderate conservative, you are partially progressive on some issues. If you're a moderate progressive, you're partly conservative on some issues. You have a major circuit and a minor circuit. And the question is, how can they both be in the same brain if they have opposite ideas? And the answer is actually very simple. The brain has circuits called mutual inhibition. That is, each one turns off the other when it's on. And then the question is, which one is on most? Because when a brain circuit's turned on, it gets stronger. So, for example, if you hear more and more of Trump, that's going to get stronger. If you hear more and more of progressive ideas or Hillary, that's going to get stronger. So now the question is, what exactly is meant by all of this? The first thing to understand is that all politics is actually about morality. That may not be obvious, but think about it for a second. If a political leader gets up and tells you his policies, here's what you should do. The assumption is that it's right, not wrong. No political leader gets up there and says, here's what we should do. It's evil, but do it. Do it and you'll be doing the devil's work, but do it. Nobody says that. Mm-hmm. They all assume it's right. Nobody gets up there and says, here's the policy, do it, but it doesn't matter. The assumption is it's right. And that means if you have opposite policies, you have opposite moral bases for those policies. Mm-hmm. Now, why is this important? It's important because everybody likes to think of themselves as being a good person. You like to think of yourself as being a moral person. We all do. And so your moral system is actually part of your identity, so that if you're voting against your moral system, you're actually voting against your very self, who you are, most deeply. Mm-hmm. And that is extremely important to understand. Values are really important in terms of elections. So when you want to understand who's voting for who and why, the first issue is what are the moral systems that you're talking about? and how are they related? And especially if you have most people being partly one and partly the other, you actually have to look at both moral systems.
You said that our capacity to hear depends on whether or not our brain wants us to hear and understand or not. What programs the brain to tell us whether or not we want to hear something?
Well, first of all, the way you were raised, the community you're in, the people you know all your life, but also language. And language is extremely important because language is not neutral. Mm-hmm. There's language that fits parts of the brain. When George Bush first came into office, George W. Bush, on the first day he used the term tax relief, and then he used it every day after that for months. Now, the word tax relief says, with relief, that you need relief when you have some affliction, something that's harming you, mm-hmm. and you want to be relieved from that affliction. Tax relief says taxes are an affliction. They're not part of citizenship. They're a bad thing for you, and anybody who's in favor of them is trying to harm you, and anybody who's against them is a good guy. Right? That's what the term means. And if you repeat it over and over again, that message gets strengthened over and over again. Now, you've heard Trump say the same thing over and over mm-hmm. and over again. And we'll go through some of what that is. But the repetition matters.
So is it fair to say that the same overly confident statements that many Americans find repugnant actually serve to attract Trump supporters? In other words, the veracity of his words is a secondary to the authority with which he says something, anything?
Yes. I did a study back about 20 years ago when I first heard or read The Contract with America, which was a conservative contract. The idea was that if you vote for me along with this contract, I will vote against the following things. I will outlaw abortion, and I will, vote for a flat tax. The first thing that bothered me was, what does taxation have to do with abortion? Mm-hmm. And then people said, I will make sure you're able to own guns. Well, what does owning guns have to do with abortion and taxation? And then they'll say, I'll vote against all environmental restrictions. Well, what does that have to do with all the other things? And then it went on for 10 kinds of policies. Mm-hmm. So I looked at this and I said, well, I disagree with all the 10 policies. What do they have to do with each other in my mind as well as their mind? And as a cognitive scientist, I realized this was a problem in my field. I didn't know right away, but I started studying it. And I did a lot of research, interviewing people, reading everything I could, listening to everything I could. And I finally asked why arch conservatives were talking about family values and what those family values were. And I realized that one of my students had written a paper pointing out that Americans have a general metaphor that the nation is a family. We have founding fathers. We send our sons and daughters to war. We have homeland security. We don't want missiles in our backyard. Well, nobody questions. What do you mean, fathers? Of course you have founding fathers. That is, the nation is understood by both, conservatives and progressives as a family, metaphorically. So then the question is, what kind of family is it? So what I did was I then checked out, looked at the two forms of politics, went back through the metaphor. Worked through the details of metaphors in the mind. That's my field. They're actually precise. And, out popped two models of the family, a nurturing parent family for progressive, a strict father family for conservatives. The nurturing parent family is very simple. It says you have two parents, if you have two. Both are responsible for their children. They start with empathy. They have to understand what their children need. They have to empathize with their children. They have to have open two-way communication with them to know what they need. They have to raise their children both to take care of themselves and others, because the parents have to take care of themselves and others. And they want their children to be fulfilled in life, so they want to know what the children need and like and want to do, but also to make sure that they're educated and healthy and, you know, have whatever enrichment they need. Mm-hmm. That's a normal nurturing parent family. You know, they're out there driving to the soccer games and so on. Now, the strict father family is very different. In a traditional strict father family, father knows best. Father has total authority because he supposedly knows right from wrong and will raise his children to do what's right and not wrong. And when they don't do what he says, because what he says is defines right and wrong, he has to punish them. It's called tough love. That is, this is an act of love, but he has to punish them painfully enough so they'll try to avoid doing what feels good and instead do what the father says is right. Mm-hmm. And if they do that, they can develop discipline, internal discipline, not to do what feels good to them, but to do whatever the father says is right. That is to maintain the father's authority. Mm-hmm. If they have that discipline, the assumption is they can go out in the world and become prosperous. Now, what if they're not prosperous? That means they're not disciplined. That means they can't be moral, and therefore they deserve their poverty, which is a common idea in mm-hmm. conservative thought. But it goes beyond this in a very important way. The assumption is that in a well-ordered world, by nature or by God, there's a moral hierarchy. That is, the people who are most moral rule. That is, authority should go with strict father morality, that form of morality. And so if you look at the world, you get a moral hierarchy. It's God above man. You know, there's a certain form of religion that's supposed to be adopted where God is a strict father. You have a man above nature. You know, nature is there for you to use any way you want. You know, it's yours. It's the rich above the poor. The rich deserve it because they're disciplined. The poor are lazy. They don't deserve it. It's employers above employees. Employers give jobs, not noticing that employees give profits. And they wouldn't give any jobs if the employees weren't giving profits. Not noticed at all in that hierarchy. And then it goes on, adults above children in 21 states. Children can be beaten with sticks and paddles in classes and on sports teams if they don't obey their teachers and coaches. And then you get things like Western culture above non-Western culture, America above other nations, America first. And then it goes even worse. It gets into bigotry. Men above women, whites above non-whites. Not all conservatives have this by any means, by the way, but there's a line here. But it continues. And then straights above gays, Christians above non-Christians. Many conservatives who are arch-conservatives have this hierarchy. That hierarchy determines radical Republican politics, which is not moderate Republican politics, very different. And it determines what Trump is going to say.
Hmm. If I understand correctly, the bottom line is that what the media does in focusing on Trump's extreme statements actually enables people to like more what he says and strengthen support for him. Is that right?
Right. He keeps repeating.
Okay.
Crooked Hillary, crooked Hillary, win, win, et cetera.
How about Hillary Clinton? Looking at her campaign through the frame that you've just given us, what should she be talking about right now?
Well, two things have been very important about her campaign. At first, she followed advisors who said she had to show she's stronger than any man and knows more policy. And she came on as the woman of steel, you know, out there, you know, with a sort of helmet hairdo and so on, et cetera. And that didn't play as well as they had hoped. And in fact, it isn't who she is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's not like that personally. I know her. She's actually a very nice, sweet person and very thoughtful, kind person. And finally, people like Joel Benenson, who's her pollster and a very smart guy, got the convention to let her be who she was, to talk about caring, about love in the election, and so on, and also to get her to come on as herself in the first debate. You know, and that has worked very well because, you know, she is like that. And what she does is communicate care. She communicates empathy, and she has care and empathy. But it's important to communicate that, which is a very important, a very major thing. And then she comes out and says, okay, because I care about the American people, here's what has to be done. And then she has actual policies and knows how to deal with it and so on, and she goes through that. And what has happened on the other side is for 25 years, people have said that you can't trust her. She's, you know, crooked. She says, you know, does this, that, and the other thing that's illegal, blah, blah, blah. And you get lots of other things, none of which has shown out to be true. But there it is. You repeat it over and over again, and it gets in the brains of the people who hear it over and over again.
What is astonishing when I talk with you is that I more and more understand what's happening right in front of us, though most of us don't explain why that's happening. One question about that. Beyond even the eventual results of this election campaign, there is so much that has changed about what is seen as permissible, how much a candidate can get away with in public rhetoric. That genie is not going back in the bottle, I don't think. So what are the likely lasting effects of this new normal, do you think?
The lasting effects are these. First of all, there are probably 20 to 30% of the population who have strict father morality, and a number of them are women who agree that, you know, their husband's authority should be supported, period. And so you have that as part of the way people understand the world. It's their worldview. It's built into their brains, you know, without having, you know, an equally balanced part of their worldview saying, hey, we're progressive, we care about everybody, et cetera, on various kinds of issues but not other issues. And what's happened is the country has become more and more conservative because of the actual efforts of things like the Leadership Institute, which has trained 160,000 people over the last 20 years to be go out and talk in their local communities and to be booked on radio and TV to think and talk conservative. You've heard it over and over, and then a lot of these things have been repeated over and over. Yeah. That's not going away. And, you know, so the question is, how do you deal with it? And the answer is by getting a citizens' communication network out there of citizens who have caring, nurturing, empathetic views and who can actually articulate them. And that's a very, very important thing. A lot of the progressive views are never said. They're never articulated. And let me give you an example of that. It turns out that in progressive politics, the version of this, of the nurturing parent family goes like this. It says, citizens care about other citizens. They work through their government to provide public resources for everybody, including business. And this happened from the beginning of our country. So from the beginning of a country, we had you know, the government providing roads and bridges, which were for businesses to get their goods there and for people to travel. It had public education, good for both individuals and for businesses to have educated workers. Then it had a national bank, great for business. It had a patent office, great for business. Interstate commerce, great for business. A judicial system, 90% for business law, great for business, and so on. In short, this country was set up so that those public resources were necessary for business. And now we've had much more. Where did computer science come from? The National Science Foundation supported it and allowed it to come into being. That was a government thing. Where did satellite communication come from? NASA and NOAA, government agencies that supported and allowed there to be satellite communication. What about GPS systems and cell phones? The Defense Department maintains a satellite system out there that is so detailed that it allows GPS cell phones to operate, because when you send a message to another part of the country or the world, it has to go up to a satellite. There are 24 of them. You go satellite to satellite to satellite all the way around, like 12 of them, and then down to where you're going. And it has to, the timing must be in nanoseconds, billionths of a second, so that if they're a millionth of a second off, you're off by 1,000 miles or 400 miles or so on your message. You won't be able to use a cell phone or a GPS system. Well, the world economy depends on cell phones. Our government is supporting not only our economy and your use of cell phones and GPS systems, but everybody's. And this is something people don't know, that the private depends on public resources. And those public resources are what allow you to be free. If you don't have education, you're not free. If you don't have health care, you're not free. You know, if you have cancer and no health care, you're not free. And similarly, if you have a business but you don't have any roads or or anything to get your ideas out there, to get your advertising out there, to get your goods out there, if you don't have airports supported by the federal government and state governments, if you don't have that, you can't run a business. In short, private enterprise and private life depends not just on private real enterprise, which it does, but it also depends on public resources. That message isn't out there. Every progressive knows this. If you go and talk to a liberal, they say, well, of course that's true. And if you ask them, have you ever said it out loud? The answer is no, they haven't.
George, do you have a strong feeling about how all of this is going to end?
I think, first of all, that Hillary will win the election. I think that the Trump supporters will be very angered. There may be violence, which would be pretty terrible. You know, we had the first firebombing this week, and there may very well be fire. There's a firebombing against the traditional Republican Party in a city where the Republicans and the Democrats were getting along. So the Republicans were not pro-Trump Republicans, refusing to talk to Democrats. And this is very important. Trump isn't going away. You know, he's got tens of millions of people out there, you know, who are real, and hundreds of thousands of people who have a really strong, strict father view that this is what's right and what is their identity. Now, the question is, will he be able to get them to form a militia, something violent, or some other means of communication to keep getting the messages out there? You can bet that they're going to be attacking Democrats and Hillary every day. So this isn't going away. This is now part of our politics, and we have to learn how to deal with it and how to talk about it and how to understand it.
As I said at the beginning, there is no way to truly summarize the important writing that George Lakoff has done around this year's election. And so let me urge every one of you listening to take the time to read George Lakoff's columns, Understanding Trump and Understanding Trump's Use of Language. We'll link to both of those on stateofbelief.com. George Lakoff is Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley, and the author of a number of important books. There's an all-new, updated edition of George Lakoff's book, Don't Think of an Elephant. It is available now. George, thank you for doing...
Thank you, Wilson. By the way, there's a new third edition of Moral Politics about this election that has just come out this week.
Terrific book. Terrific book. And George, thank you for giving us time and being on State of Belief again.
Always great to be here, Walton.
Take care.
I'm glad you're doing all that you're doing.